Okay, I'm going to start because I'm going to get through the review portion first, since some of you weren't here. And so when people roll in, they can come into the new material. Okay, so welcome to session 4. Our title today is Towards a Common Purse, From Financial Individualism to Communal Interdependence. As you can probably see, Daniel is not here today. He is traveling to Canada because we were pushed back a week. We weren't anticipating this week to be the last session. So, but he sends his regards and love, obviously. But and he and I did work on this portion, so I'm not like, it's not just me. So we've been working together on this. So, okay, so we're just going to go over briefly the last 3 sessions because all of the building blocks kind of converged to today. So if you missed or haven't listened to the online versions, there is audio and also the PowerPoint presentation, both on the CAN website and then also our church community Facebook page. So in the first session, we kind of laid out for you what kind of ethos do we live in? What is the American dream according to the system that we live in? And so, especially in the financial, like, matters, like, what does it look like? And so, the first session, we talked about how financial matters are considered private. It's based on radical individualism. There's the notion of inheritance by family and then also, quote, unquote, fairness. Debt determines creditworthiness, which we went through in session 3. Ownership is happiness. So that's something that the media tells us all the time. If we own stuff, we're happy. We need stuff to be happy. And it funds this idea of consumerism. A lot of times in a consumeristic capitalistic perspective, charity is considered good, but you can only give if you have access. So charity is something that only wealthy people can participate in. And then there's a bootstrap attitude towards financial savviness. So if you're financially savvy, it's like, I did it myself and I got no help from anybody else. I paid a financial advisor to do it, whatever. It's a very individualistic exercise. But we said, you know, from our church perspective and when we have faith, we say something very different, which is that help is available within community. Not everything is private. And you can get help from resources outside of yourself. In your immediate family. Sometimes families, especially like immigrant families, don't have that kind of resourcing within the family system. So we say in a church community, there's help outside of that. We need to pursue radical community that practices interdependence that will lead to communal financial freedom. So we don't just celebrate individuals getting out of debt. We celebrate the community doing that together. Also, kinship and the expansion of family. Kinship is a notion that, like, there is a way to relate to people that is beyond just family. And so, you know, Jesus talks about that in the Bible as well. Like, who is your mother? Who is your brothers and sisters? So we want to expand the idea of, like, who is family? Who do we give to? Who do we care for? And then in our church, character and responsibility determines creditworthiness. There's joy in sharing. And the spirit of generosity is more important than how much you give or receive. So the quantity of giving and receiving does not determine how creditworthy you are in this community. And the gratitude of receiving generosity is a driving force that leads to generosity towards others. In the second session, we went through a brief racialized history of America. The basic premise is that the economy is set up on genocide of indigenous peoples and theft of land. It's based on slavery and the continual oppression of African Americans and black bodies. There is a continual exclusion and exploitation of immigrants and their labor and anti-immigrant legislation. Bottom line is the system is set up to pit people of color against one another as people of color systemically stripped of communal cultures that they come with. And then they're forced into hyper individualism in order to serve as props for whites to be able to exclusively build wealth. So even though there are exceptions of people of color being able to build wealth, it's really their participation in the white system in order to get it there. But by and large, the system is set up so that black bodies and immigrant bodies are used to prop up white wealth. The point is that we are all victims of being pawns of the system, and we must create an alternative economy that's built on trust and community and character. So if we continue to just let the system be as it is, then what we're doing is we're continually perpetuating the wealth building and the privilege of white folks. But in an alternative community where we are multicultural, then we really take those things into consideration. In our third session, we talked about creditworthiness. The definition we went through, kind of FICO scores, and how the world, like this American system, views you as a risk or as how creditworthy you are. So, and it's also determined, if you look at it from a broad perspective, it's determined by debt, how much debt you can carry and how much debt you can manage. So there is incentive in the system in and of itself for you to be in debt and to continue spending, which perpetuate a consumeristic mindset. So the spirit of more and more purchases and more purchase of things you can't afford, and you have to take out loans for it. And that's how you become more creditworthy in this country, which is not the case in most other countries, actually. The debt system, there's a lot of, most countries are built on cash systems. So it's built on how much assets you have in order to determine how creditworthy you are. Also, a lot of kinship things. So like your application will have, like in Japan, for example, you have a cosigner that has a greater history, education, like those things are taken into consideration in determining your creditworthiness. So this oppressive psychology of debt has become normalized and individualized. So history shows us that it's normal to take out a car loan. It's normal to take out a mortgage. And we see that as a normal thing, and it's actually a good thing. And then also this individualism is a foundation of capitalism that causes and perpetuates the psychology of debt. So that's what we covered last session. Sorry, we're going through it real fast, but you can go back and listen to it, all of it, and look through the slides if you want to. And also, just so that we're all aware, if you are kind of younger and before taking out student debt, or you are looking into going to school and things, or looking to build credit, we're going to have a separate session for younger people, whereas like some of the older people have like debt management things. So look out for the calendars for that. So, and like how to build credit and how to be smart about it before you make major mistakes, because I've done that. So, and then we also went through last week that, psychology as a practice is really insufficient to access true freedom and to have a good assessment of like all of this that's happening in the American system. We talked about how God is the owner and author of all things. Our fundamental belief is that God allows us to be stewards, and we are to be faithful and responsible with the good gifts that he gives us. And that's therefore, this is about character transformation, not getting control of your psychology or even your finances. It's really about taking responsibility for the good gifts that God has given us, from time to talents and gifts and assets and monies or whatever you may have, and to give to one another. And the gift can be something that's completely intangible, like something like, for example, people of color may not have the assets built up, but they have the sense of community and sense of kinship that they can teach us. And that's something that is a gift as well. And so we need to look at impoverishment and wealth, not based on how much assets you have and how much you can accrue, but really like what kind of gift can we contribute to the community as a whole? So we have a very different standard of what generosity and receiving looks like, because there's a lot of people who can have a lot of money, but is completely poor of spirit and stingy. So, and actually receiving actually is an indicative of relational centeredness, which leads to giving out of that receiving, so out of that gratitude, and how we need, again, community and kinship. One of the things we did talk about is that the gift of the church is from God, is a language of confession and transparency and vulnerability with one another. That is a gift, and because of that, when we have needs and when we are, you know, in need of help, then that is an availability to us because we've been redeemed by God, and therefore we can give that grace to one another. So spirit of generosity is character that's defined by gratitude and differentiation. Okay, so now we are in session 4. We're going to talk about towards a common purse, from financial individualism to communal interdependence. My goal for today is to, one, do an exegesis, which is not really exegesis from like the traditional perspective you've been to seminary, but really like how do we define the explicit and implicit underpinnings of Cann's ethos to generate the spirit of generosity. I really want to talk about our life together, like what that looks like, has looked like in the past, what it looks like now. And I also really want to dream with you guys about what next steps are for you individually, but also as a community. And there's going to be a time for discussion and reflection in this session, which we didn't really quite have in the previous sessions. So I want to give us breathing space to kind of take in the information and like reflect. If you want to share, you are more than welcome to do so. If you don't want to, and if you just want to write a card, there's cards available on your seats. You can do that. And again, those index cards, if you want to fill them out and you want us to reach out to you personally, leave us your contact information. We'd be happy to consult with you, or you know, if you want to talk about anxiety and fears, we can do that. Or if you just want to do budgeting, we can help you with that too. So feel free to do that. Or we can find your resources within the community to connect you with the right person. So I've been here for like almost 11 years as staff person in this church. So I know a lot of what anyone can do in our church. And so does Pastor Jin, and so do other staff members. So we can get you connected. So okay, so it's not shifting. Okay, so what does a spirit of generosity look like here at Cann? So one of the things that I wanted to talk about today is I'm sure a lot of you have gone through the membership class, new member class, which was offered yesterday, actually. But one of the things that we talk about membership that's different in our church than other churches, I think, is that our membership is defined as like not just a club membership card, but it's really like you are coming into the fold of our family. So we see ourselves more like a family structure, and we offer kinship to you from the get-go. But if you take us seriously and become a member, then we take you seriously as well as a family member. So that doesn't mean that like you need to trust us fully right away from the get-go. It may be a process for you, and that's totally fine. But our disposition to new members is that you are family, and we will treat you as such. But if you're, you know, a family member that needs time to warm up, totally fine. We're totally fine with that. But we offer you the trust. We offer you the care. We offer you resources. At the risk of you leaving, at the risk of you, you know, doing whatever. So, but that's something that we can do because our community has a core family value that is very, very strong, and not one individual can break that. So we offer that to you out of like this collective love and kinship we already have, and we offer it to you with open hands. And we also look at family from a multicultural perspective, and this is very, very important. Because as you probably know, you each come from a family system, a very particular family system that is colored by your culture, your race, your like the gender, how many parents you have. All these things play into a family system that you understand to be family. But for us, we are incorporating all sorts of perspective from staff from various different cultures and various different perspectives. Single families, to, you know, like split families, absentee fathers, whatever. But we have this collectivist mindset that there is holes in individual, family systems. And we try to create something that's different. That's not codependent, like a lot of Asian families are, and not like abstract and, uncaring, like some white families are, and definitely not abusive. So we try not to be, a trigger for you as much as we can. But if you are triggered, to have a system where we can care for you. So family is really redefined by people who have been here for a long time. And that's the core out of which we offer that kinship again. And that multicultural perspective really does matter to us. And anybody who's come into our fold has informed us or changed us or shaped us in some way. And the one thing that we do have particularly is that we are a family with structure and we're a family with authority. And that's defined by character and responsibility. So a lot of times authority in family structures is given by who can earn the most money, right? Or who is the male of the family. There's a lot of, like, who holds the control of the family. So those are really the family systems that most of us come from, regardless of culture, regardless of, you know, race and all. And there's obviously a deep plethora of other things that play into that. But what we want to talk about at our church is, okay, what is authority and how does the credibility of authority built here? And that's really about, not necessarily about having power or control, but really how much responsibility you take for yourself and for others. So, for example, I have, I work in the kitchen a lot here at church and also in my own home. But so it's not necessarily that I get to have things my way in the kitchen, whether it be home or church, because I cook a lot or because I have authority in the space. It's really because I take responsibility for that space the most. I spend the most time there and I give of myself in that space. And so I arrange it in a way because it's for me to serve the community it's set up so that the responsibility can be taken in the most efficient and best way for the sake of the community. So does that make sense? It's not about control. It's not about me being particular about certain things. If I was particular, I would want certain things like ants to never be there or, you know, things like that. But there's a sense of taking ownership, but in a way that's about being responsible for yourself and for your community that creates that authority. Our church is about, our life together, I want to talk a little bit about this. We have a lot of things going on. I'm sure if you walked into our church for the first time, it's like, what a weird church. I mean, that's how I felt when I walked in. Because there's all sorts of stuff going on and you're not really sure where the social groups are or how to plug in or, you know, who to connect with sometimes. And a lot of it is because we're a church that really wants our people to drive who we are. And so we have this thing called high risk, low anxiety. High risk meaning we take a lot of risks in trying new things and trying things to meet the needs of our community, but we want to do it with low anxiety. Low anxiety meaning you're not trying to control something or you're not trying to control people. You're not trying to fix something out of your Christ complex. But really, how do we meet the needs? And if I was telling Felice today that I was going to use her as an example, but Felice, she started this mommy's group on Thursdays where she needed to not be alone in the house with a baby all day long, but noticed that a lot of moms were like that. So then she just called out to them and said, hey, let's have a play day at church because we have a lot of toys there. There's a park down there. Maybe we could just hang out once a week and then just be with each other and maybe have lunch together or whatever. And it started this weekly thing for moms who were home alone with the kids and probably going mad because they weren't having adult conversations. And it's just too much for one person to be caring for multiple little people, you know? And so, yeah. So but that's not something that, you know, the staff noticed and said we needed to do this. But we want people to take the risk and then lead something and see if that's something that our community needs. So the high risk, low anxiety is a very, very important, tenet that we've had since the inception. That's how we became a church in the first place. I will say too, the staff, our church is really small church compared to the large group of people that have won, been in seminary, and also two who are staff. So like about like 10% of our church is like somewhat staff or staff. And then a huge number in addition to that are deacons and elders. So we have like a really thick like layer of leaders and people who are very intentionally involved in our community. And so a lot of things that we do is shaped by that theology of an ethos. I mean, it's very intentional why we do things the way we do. So we'll talk about that. And then the goal of our, the goal here is to have an alternative economy. We were talking about, what we want to do with these practices that we have in our church is to have less and less of the hyper-individualistic, capitalistic, isolating, alienating system to have impacts in our lives. So what we do in this church is really important, and not just for you, but also for your kids, to create a system where we are less and less impacted by all these like negative things that's happening out in the world to impact us. It's still going to impact us in one way or another, but how do we create a system where we're less impacted by those things? So, okay. We're having a hard time moving on. Okay. So I wanted to give some examples. Here are some examples of things that have been staff-led, but past and current experience that we've had in this ministry. Some things are no longer here, but some things are still currently going on. A lot of people may not know this, but we have what's called a Good Samaritan Fund. Our church budget has allocated a certain amount of money for people who are in urgent need to be able to access emergency funds at no interest at all, and they can pay it back with an arrangement with an elder and our pastor to figure out what is the best way for you to pay us back, or like if it's like a small enough loan, you know, one time or whatever.
Or it's a grant.
Or it could be a grant. It could be a scholarship as well. Some people have gotten scholarships to school. It's not a lot of money. We are not a very wealthy church, but we try to have that set aside for emergencies and for meeting people's needs who may need a surgery or something like that, but they don't have the funds to do that. And it's also, you know, discerned by really like credible, responsible people in our church to be able to work with you in a way that is feasible and, you know, where you don't feel burdened by that. So if you're in need, that's something you can, you know, speak to your elders about or anybody on staff, and we can direct you towards Pastor Jin, or you can talk to him directly. He's right here. One of the things I really did want to talk about is some of the stories that are in our church. And obviously, I'm really akin to the fellowship meals. The way that that started was before we used to have a deacon of fellowship that would go and get snacks. And then after service, people would come down and eat snacks and coffee. And then, you know, they would go their way. But what happened was, a couple of the deacons, we had it for a long time, but then there was a new crop of deacons and nobody wanted to do it. So nobody did it. So we had, you know, like random snacks out, but nobody came down. So for a few years, we had this like really sad post-service. Like we had this great service, but we have nowhere to go. And a lot of people were going out to eat, but see, like our church is a very intercultural and intergenerational church. So it would segment itself. So a lot of the elderly people went out together. A lot of the young people went out, but then the singles went out, but then the college students couldn't afford to go out every week. And then there was this, you know, oh, we'll pay for you. But then they felt bad about it. So they were just, oh, I have homework. And so people didn't stay. And the kids were starving by the time they came out of Sunday school, and all the families were, you know, having to head home and cook lunch. And there was just like a lot going on that was not great for our community. And so what ended up happening was there were a series of discussions by the board of deacons, and try to remedy this. And at the time I had started working full time, and I stopped being full time intern at our church. So I stopped doing college ministry. I had little to no responsibilities in the church except being part time staff. And At the same time, Laura and Mikkel had started the church garden. This was started like the spring before I started, because it started in September, like 7 years ago. 7 years ago. So, and they had all these like leftover produce at the end of the summer, like huge zucchinis and like tons of like overgrown huge tomatoes, and like they didn't even know what to do with it. So I had this like meal where I was like, oh, why don't we just think, praise God for the harvest, and then do a meal. So we did this garden like lunch after service, and I was like, actually, I can do this every week. Like, this is something I can do, because I was like freer on the weekends, and I wanted to serve the church in a different way. And how do I do that when I'm working full time? And I was like, I know how to cook, and I'm all about healthy foods. And, I also want to save the church money, and create a space where people can fellowship. So what started happening was, Pastor Jen and I talked, and we talked about having, and also this is also when we're having declines with our income because of the market. So like a lot of people had lost jobs, and we had like small budgets for everything. So I was like, okay, we're going to do it outside of the church budget, and we will do a free will offering. People who can afford it, and they would have gone out and spent like $60 on a Sunday lunch anyway for the family, they can give a 20. And if like five people give 20, or 10 people give tens, I can make a meal for 150 people under $100. So I can do that. And so we started this ministry, and it took a long time for me to figure out how to serve with like a good heart and cleanly. And it's been a process for me, but it also, like that first Sunday where we had actually like first month of serving lunch, and hearing the buzz in the fellowship hall from having it be completely empty to people eating together and fellowshipping and catching up and talking, it just like made me cry. Cause it was like, this is what we've been missing for the entire time. And like, I get to serve in this way and create space for hospitality where we can invite our visitors to come and like join us and get to know us, which was missing for a long time. So this is why I'm really passionate about still serving in the kitchen. It's something that is not easy to do on a weekly basis, especially when winter comes. But it's so theologically something that makes sense to me, because we break bread together. What does communion mean if we don't actually eat together, right? I mean, that's just a symbol, but what I do is like really serve communion. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, how do we do this that's economically just? For me, like, if you have like six kids and you are scraping to make it, what a relief to just have one meal that is like affordable, like you don't have to pay for. Somebody else will offset the costs. And where, you know, you don't have to rush home and cook something on a rush. You could just eat here together and then enjoy your time and fellowship here. Like, what? You know, of course this is something we should do, right? And so that, to me, like, was very theologically intentional in the way that we did it, and the way we offered it. I think it's changed, it had different phases and seasons, but that's really the reason why fellowship came to be. Do you want to talk about community housing? I know community housing is kind of a mysterious thing for people who don't live in it. And it is a... And you have to also know the history of community housing too. It all started with some girls deciding, hey, like, we love church, and it's really hard for me to live with like my college friends or that may have different values than I do. So they decided to live together. The girls' house, this man, it was like 12 years ago or something.
No.
10 years ago. Yeah, Tao was original.
Yes.
OG. OG community housing.
Laura.
Laura and Karen.
Karen Kong.
Anyway, so that's where it started. And it kind of expanded. A lot of different people tried to do that after that. So there was a boys' house. Literally, it was in the same duplex. The girls' house, and then like there was a guy's side, and the boys started living together. We had Jordan Huber. Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Because he was married to Telsey.
You go, girl.
That's why he's so great. He's been shaped out of the, by all the women.
Oh, he's hanging there.
Then we had, you know, various, like, I was an intern, and I was, like, living with a couple in our church who had a basement apartment. So I was able to live there for free. Some people then started buying houses. So Paul Kim bought a house and housed, like, I don't even know, like 30 people by the end of that house. But people are in and out. And then there was a shift several years ago where we decided that it's really, really good to have houses around the church property where it was close, where it was walkable, where cars weren't as much of an issue. And then there's so many resources around the church community. So Pastor Jim purchased the Fink House
6 years ago.
Wow. Yep. And a month after that, then Pastor Jen and I purchased the Chatham House with Laura, and we started that house. And we stopped renting. Like, we just decided that it was better for us to keep the resources within our church family instead of, like, pay rent to, like, a landlord. And then we bought the lake house with you and Paul Moses.
Right next to our church.
Right next to our church. But... You know, like, so I think our neighborhood kind of knows that we're looking to buy a house. So they kind of come to us, too. Like, hey, we're looking to sell a house. Would you be interested? And we have that kind of relationship now around the neighborhood, too. And so each house is very, very different. It's really shaped by the function, number one, but two, the people who live in it. So the Fink House, for example, was purchased under the premise that it would be housing for the underground seminary students. So it started off that way, and obviously not every student needs housing in that way, and so it's been kind of half and half in the last couple years. The Chatham House, we have people who are in our 30s who are mostly working full-time. So when Laura and I started our house... We wanted a little more stability because, like, we kind of talked about what does it mean for a woman who's, like, entering into, like, 30s who's not married or have a family to be settled. Because that's something that's not necessarily afforded to somebody who may not be married or have kids. So how do we, like, have a sense of stability and permanence without being married? So, like, we were very theologically intentional about talking about that. What does that look like? And how do we care for each other as a family? And so our house started that way. And our premise was, like, we really want people who aren't transitional in our house. So our experiment is a social experiment to some degree of, like, how do we have stability in people who are committed to the church but are single and want the same kind of permanence? So we don't have a lot of transitions. You won't hear a lot about Chatham people leaving or coming in as much. Whereas, like, the Fink House, it's like, you know, every 2 years they have a transition after the seminary graduates and then things need to shift around. And the Lake House as well. Lake House is a little more unique. I don't know what to say about that, but... But you have to understand too, financially, all of our houses are connected in one way or another. So the Fink House is set up so that it's a lot more common purse than any other house, because it functions through the seminary. So they pay into the seminary and then there's a budget for household things out of that kind of allocation of funds from there. Our house has actually, we collect excess rent above and beyond the mortgage payment. And the excess goes to other community houses that may not be making that much money or is like doesn't have enough renters or not enough rent coming in. That offsets the cost of that. And we've stably been doing that since the inception of our house. So we've been able to help with projects when Fink House was under construction to if there's somebody who needed to leave and there's like missing rent, we can help cover for that. But it all is funneled through, you know, the church and Pastor Jane to allocate those funds. We don't actually know where the money's going to actually, but we just trust that it's used appropriately. And we don't have any democratic say or anything because why, you know? So we just trust the church. So So there's some inner workings like that throughout the community housing. So if somebody loses a job or like is having a hard time with their job or keeping up their finances, we provide coaching and help to make sure that they're responsible. But then if there's a need, we can like lower the housing costs. Everything is very negotiable and everything is dependent and prorated based on income you have. So obviously, you know, someone like Maggie or I or Nari who have a stable corporate job will be able to afford a higher rent than somebody who's like, you know, Casey who has his own business, you know. So we definitely have those things in mind and it's brokered by, you know, the leadership in our church to determine what is fair and what is equitable and what is responsible. And we take into consideration debt to income ratio as well. So community housing may seem like, you know, we have so much more access to like the center of the church. I mean, it is true. The proximity of the, in the location allows us for us to be participating, more fully in the life of the church on a week, day-to-day basis. But I will say I have lived away from this neighborhood and it's really not that, the location doesn't quite determine that per se, because I could have weeks where I like see nobody because I'm just so busy with work and I go home and I just see my roommates. And even then some of my roommates, like this week, Maggie and I are the only ones there for like 2 days, you know? So, I mean, I see everybody, but you know, my heart is to participate. So when things are going on, I show up, you know, and I come here. I did, when we were looking at houses, it was an intentional move for us to purchase a house close to the church. We looked at houses like we just really wanted to be in walking distance of the church. That is an intentional move that we made so that like our life together during the week is more full and enriched by kind of the locality and things happening. And also because, you know, like, for example, Jordan Wright had to get surgery this week. You know, I was able to take her to the hospital and then bring her back. And it wasn't a big deal because we're so close together. And it gives us, like, resourcing and other adults available in the community that may have a little more flexible hours or, like, more cars or whatever to take each other to, you know, Turbo Tim's to pick up a car or, you know. So that does happen more often here because of locality. But we are trying to do that with our parishes as well. So we're trying to create geographic connections. It may seem like it's concentrated here, but it's really because we've been doing it for a long time and a lot of us have been staff. But we are trying to recreate some of that within the geographic locations and the parishes. So it is really important to show up to those things and participate. Yes. Let's see. And then the underground seminary, their whole model is to not have debt by the end of the 2 years. That's really important. So we have the church garden that has gone through different phases. Before it was just for the fellowship and then it turned to just the seminary. And then now it's kind of open to whoever wants to do it. Church cleanup day, the Jubilee campaign. These are all things that we are doing that fosters this spirit of generosity. Some of the examples of things that are led by members. Some things are brokered by the church, but so there's, you know, people who have cars that they don't need anymore or are like upgrading or whatever, and it's not worth, you know, getting $1,000 for them, then they may donate cars to our church. So we've had a fleet of tons of different used cars. It's almost like Pastor Jin's a used car salesman. He owns a lot of cars. But the church has all these cars that are available. So if something breaks down, we have extra cars that people can use. But also, there may be needs of cars from individuals that we can give cars to as well. So we broker that kind of transfer and also help fix cars before it gets transferred to a member so that they can have a stable car. I mean, obviously it depends on what we have and what's available and things like that. But we've had a lot of generous members that are willing to get rid of their old cars and would rather get a tax exemption and write off from the church than to make a couple hundred bucks. So, those things have happened. It's not always the best to in best shape, like the cars that we get, but we do, what we can with, what we're given. But you know, things like that do happen. And not just cars, but, you know, I'm sure people have had things given to them, right? Like, hey, does anyone have a saw or whatever? Oh, I have one you can borrow. Or, you know, things like that happen on Facebook a lot. Obviously, the Thursday play dates. We used to have this thing called the sharing room. This is another, like, amazing thing that we did that I loved. It was basically the church thrift store. And all these people would donate their clothes and baby stuff and, you know, like, gently used things. And it would be set up like it was in that room over there. Pastor Jen called it the sharing is caring room. So we called it the sharing room. But the Just Do It cell group, they're like the older women in our church that were kind of tired of doing, like, running the church before we came. They decided they were going to run this. So they organized everything. We had racks up, and anyone could go in there and take what they needed and then also give to it. And the cool thing was, like, our staff people, because we were all underpaid interns, we would take clothes all the time from there. And we'd wear it, but there was this culture of, like, normalcy that we all shared and be like, hey, that sort of looks great on you. That was mine, you know? But it wasn't like, oh, only poor people take from this. It's like, no, we all do this. This is a normal thing. And the staff was intentional about creating normalcy and saying, this is normal for us to take and give. Give and take. This is what we do as a community. And I love it. And, like, a lot of kids' clothes got transferred over. You know, things like you can't, like, even car seats. I'm sure there's, like, expiration dates that you can't get from thrift stores and things. But we can share that if it's still good, you know, amongst ourselves. And so, except that it was a lot of maintenance, so the Just Do It group was like, we can't do this anymore, so we sold everything at the rummage sale. So we do that too, rummage sale. I don't know if you've noticed, but every season, the decor changes in our church, whether it be fellowship or the flags outside or the banners in the front. That's done by, like, these amazing women from the same, you know, Josette and Bev take the time to create seasons for us without anybody knowing about it and put tapestries up and banners up to kind of, like, welcome in the different, like, liturgical season for us. So, you know, things like that happen. The rides to and from church, the meal trains for new moms, obviously the rummage sale. So, okay, so here are some tips. If you're individuals, this is something that I would suggest if you are a participant in this church. Number one, do your homework. What that means for me is do your homework and dig into your family of origin issues, how you are wired, your cultural trappings and shortcomings. Recognize how you understand authority. And how you engage or disengage in community. Like, know yourself and understand how you can be your own kind of, you know, pitfall in engaging in this kind of stuff. Like, really know yourself so that you don't blame other people and you don't blame, like, the church structure for not caring for you. Like, really understand who you are. And because if you do, then you can ask for help, especially if you have urgent needs. Make your needs known. There may be resources around the church that you don't know about, but we know about, and we could just get you connected. Or, you know, if you need, like, specific help, we may be able to just help you on the spot. So ask for help. Like, there's nothing wrong with people. Like, everyone has needs. Everyone has different needs at different times. We just have to free each other, and so we just have to connect you to the right resources. Participate in our life together. This is really important. Like I said, everything we do in our church is very intentionally crafted, and it's meant for you to be able to foster these, like, the spirit of generosity. It is really important that you show up. And when you show up and you get to know people, you'll also see the needs of other people and realize, okay, maybe, like, we can connect together, or maybe I can help you in this. Maybe you can help me in this, right? Like, get to know people by showing up. And that's, like, a really, really important thing. Be responsible with your financial life. Have a budget. One thing that I've told people who have a tendency to kind of be scared is budget a specific budget line for generosity. Like, have this space where when somebody asks you to go out, you're not like, oh, I don't have money. And then, like, that hesitation is really offensive because to the person inviting you, it feels like, oh, you don't want to hang out with me. But it's really, like, a fear of budget, right, of finances. But if you have this, like, oh, I'm going to keep, like, $50 so I don't have to do that, then you could just be like, oh, yeah. Or, like, can you help with, you know, financial giving in this particular way? Like, you're like, oh, yeah, I have $50 budgeted this month for that. So, you know, like, if it's not natural to you to just give and you have a pang of anxiety, just set that aside. So just so for your psychological well-being and so that you're not offensive in your relationships, like create space for generosity. And it doesn't have to be a monetary amount. It could be like 2 hours of my week. I'm going to be generous. If somebody wants to just have coffee with me, I'm going to set aside 2 hours so that if somebody asks or if I want to ask somebody, I have that time. Be generous with your time, you know? Be high risk, low anxiety. Try new things. Take more responsibility, not control. You know, don't think about, like, what I need and I need to control this and these people so I get what I need. Like, really, like, just try to take responsibility for yourself and others. Like, how do I help this person because I care for them, right? Value gifts. See, like, really true impoverishment in yourself. Like, really have values, like, flipped around. It's not about money. It's not about how much you have. It's, like, how you give, how you invest in your relationships, how you're present. Like, just don't hang out and, like, be on your phones. Like, be present with your time. Value the time you have with people, you know, and care about that space. Like, keep that space clean so that when you're hanging out, you're not bothered by, like, the piling up dishes on the side. Like, be intentional and be responsible with the space and time you have. Yes. So that's really kind of the wrap up for, like, where we're at and what we've done. I do want to have a little bit of a discussion of, like, what are some next steps for you personally, or, like, some things that you heard of, examples of things we do in the community that you can participate in or want to help in. What are some ideas you have of what we could do or what you want to do, like, see flourish in our church? What are some things that are holding you back? You know, you don't have to share in person. If you want, you can. And what are some learnings and reflections from the last four sessions, the last session, that you've kind of reflecting on? Like, what are you excited about? What are you kind of scared of? But I just want to open up the floor for that, if anyone want to share. Otherwise, you can write index cards. We can take the time to do that, too. Kind of a quiet group today. Isaac?
I think, so in terms of doing my homework, just realizing, like, kind of my financial character inheritance from my family.
Mm-hmm.
What I get from my mom is, like, she loves being, like, lavish and generous and, like, just going all out on, like, you know, spending money so that she can, like, do things for people. Mm-hmm. But what I get from her is, like, she's really disorganized financially, and, like, things just get, like, way out of control,
mm-hmm.
Like, really fast, and just, like, runs out of money halfway through the month.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, the flip side of that is my dad is extremely organized and, like, knows how to build wealth and how to, like, run a business, which he did for many years. But he's also, like, very stingy. Yeah. And, like, he does giving, but it's, like, with strings attached. And so it's, like, almost money as a means of control.
Mm.
So, like, you know, there's weaknesses on both sides of that.
Sure.
So, like, how can I take the organization from my dad, or maybe learned that from other people, because I don't have strings attached. Imparting knowledge to me. And still keep that spirit from my mom, which is like, just, you know, give constantly and, like, you know, create hospitality and spaces for people. That's kind of the next steps for me.
Cool. Thanks for sharing.
Social anxiety has held me back. And I don't feel like I've been understood very well. I think people collate symptoms and don't dialogue. And I, my hard person to understand if you don't talk with me. Because if you just simply look at my behavior, you're not going to necessarily understand me. And and when I don't get enough social interaction, my personality changes in ways that make it even harder for me to have more social interaction. So that's part of why the dialogue part is important. So, And I also think that when you talk about assessing something based on their responsibility and things like you can be infantilized in some respects and not others. And that's where the dialogue part helps with recognizing that even though someone's infantilized in some respects, there are other areas where they are very much an adult. But so you have to kind of be mindful of that.
That's true. I think that's the thing, too, about being a small church. One of the gifts is that we get to really know people. And so I think what you're saying is really important, communicating and, like, really understanding and having a spirit of, like, understanding before judgment. I think that's definitely core. Thanks for sharing, David.
That spirit of non-judgment is really helpful for the transparency piece.
That's
and
true.
I've been very grateful that that seems to be people are already more comfortable sharing that with each other. And not necessarily everyone. Not everyone has to give a testimony about how much debt they have or what they struggle with personally or with their parents or whatever. But that we are more aware that there are relationships that we can do that in, and that our leadership is more, it's not that we're more available, it's just that we know that they're more accessible now. And I think that that's really empowering. I feel collectively more empowered to look at our debt and to not be afraid or in shame. To me, that's very, very encouraging.
Claire?
I think for me it's hard to like balance being responsible and not being too controlling or restrictive. So like budgeting stresses me out, and like I feel like I'm either spending way too much or too little. Like, so if I have a budget, I feel like I'm like controlling a lot, and it like creates anxiety for me rather than just like saving a certain amount and then like letting myself spend the rest of it more flexibly for me. So like learning how to do that, because like I say for my parents, very very generous, but like zero budgeting. So yeah.
What lousy parents you have.
Was that a judgment?
Well, that's something actually I came across growing up here too. My parents are very financially, it seemed like they were financially stable. And now that as an adult, I learned a lot of the things that they struggled with that they didn't really share with me to create a safe space for me and my siblings. And so, but one of the things that my sister said really caught my attention was like, she never learned what 401k or IRA or any of that stuff was, because our parents also didn't share any of that either. So they had some sort of knowledge. It wasn't that great of knowledge because they're immigrants, but so some of the knowledge wasn't passed on. And so, you know, with my job, my sister and I talk a lot about what she should do with her money, because she makes quite a bit more than I do, my little sister. So I'm helping her to kind of plan for her what is helpful for her without creating that same anxiety and control. Because she oscillates between being completely out of control to, like, too controlling. There's, like, not this, like, middle ground of generosity and flexibility. So, and that's also something that you just learn when you become older, because things get more complicated. So when you are younger and you have a simpler budget, it is good to stick with it and have that discipline of sticking with it, without developing anxiety, obviously. But as things get, when you become older and your budgeting becomes more complex, then you'll know how to manage it and then still build in elasticity and flexibility within that, because it, things don't go as easily as things did when I was in college. So definitely, like, that discipline in and of itself that you budget, that is really important. And you'll learn, you know, by practicing it every month, what that flexibility looks like for you.
I'll just add that budgeting is a helpful discipline, but it's only a helpful discipline as a substitute for character. When one has mature character, one does not spend frivolously or foolishly. One is frugal. This is just basic mature character. One is frugal with oneself and generous with others. And if one has that kind of mature character, then one doesn't really need to budget, because you'll live within your means, and there will always, and because you're not really spending money on yourself, there's actually money to be generous with other people. In young marriages, a lot of the times the spouses have rules. Okay, we got to talk like this, and then we're gonna, you know, share like that, and we have to do these chores, and you have to do those chores. When people are mature, you do out of your character and not out of a sense of equity and justice, because rules and regulations that enforce equity assumes the other person is going to take advantage if they can. That's what rules and regulations are about. Budgeting assumes that I'm going to be sloppy or not attentive. So, yes, you know, we live in a society that endlessly infantilizes, that endlessly traumatizes. So these are steps we need to take. But the real goal long term is to develop the kind of mature character where one does not need rules or regulations or laws. This is the model that Jesus set himself. He was hardly ever operating out of budgets and formalities like that, because what he wanted in his heart was generally good for himself and for others around him. So I think that, you know, this kind of exercise is critically important, because you got to take step by step. You got to go there step by step, right? And some of us just grew up in not very constructive homes in a lot of areas, including budgeting. So we need to have some rules and regulations and budgets and things like that. But I think that it's helpful for us to remember that it's nevertheless an intermediary step. One other thing I would mention is, in my counseling, you know, you think that budgeting is a technical thing. Like, I need to save this much money and spend it and this, that, and the other. It's also a psychological thing. Mm. We have people in our church who are afraid, believe it or not, afraid to get out of debt. Because when you have debt, it makes you motivated to work. I got to go to work. I got to, you know, and I got to work hard because you got to make these debt payments. But once you finish paying debt, you're like, what am I working for? What am I living for? Where's all that momentum and drive for? Or some people were punished in such a way that, okay, if you were let's say you have multiple siblings and there was one responsible sibling, that responsible sibling got even more work, more responsibilities. So, like, it was almost like the parents punished the good child for being good and the sloppy ones got away with it. Then those kinds of people, when they grow up, are like, they don't want to be competent in some area, like finances, because if they are, there's just this fear that somebody is going to pile on more work for them and it's unfair. So even like being competent in your finances might create the fear that you're going to be taken advantage of for your competence. So we have all kinds of psychological blocks and weird motivations that come from our families of origin that we have to work out. Because people who don't work out their psychology, some of them get out of debt and then they go right back in because of the psychology that they have not been able to overcome. So people who don't heal are basically in this area are going to be in financial crisis their whole lives, unless they take healing seriously.
So, but I mean, to add to that too, budgeting is a really good training wheel. Like, and I still budget a ton. And it's really just for me to be aware of where my money is going. I think before when I went out, spun out of control with my spending, it was really because I really just was afraid to look at my finances, and I was afraid to take responsibility for it. So I didn't look at it, and it just spun out of control. But now, like, budgeting, like, I'm not really controlling about my budget. I have general categories and I have general allocations. Some things are like just must haves, right? But the other things I'm pretty flexible about, and I'm very aware of myself and thinking, oh, I'm being indulgent. I know, like, there's a limit, like, there's a time, like, as soon as I do it, I'm like, I've gone too far, right? And then I stop. But it's a tool for me to gauge where I am psychologically, where I'm like, oh, I felt entitled to that. Why? You know, go make that return, you know? Or am I, like, spending because I need therapy? Like, the funniest story that John Nelson tells about me is that when I was, like, in the midst of this credit card debt and just depression, I would go to Target on Fridley, you know, like, right off of 694 in Central. And I just walk around, and I pick stuff up, and I walk around, and I put it back, and I walk around, because, like, I knew I wasn't supposed to spend, but I was, like, doing retail therapy. And I got caught by John Nelson one time, and I was just, like, wandering around, like, aimlessly with, like, this, like, blank face. And he was just like, what are you doing?
You squirt shelf lifting.
No, I would never steal. But he just, like, caught me just, like, going around and around, like, the store for hours, like, doing nothing. Yeah, and he was just like, what are you doing? This is, like, right as I was, this is, like, what, 8 years ago or whenever.
What was he doing all those hours?
I don't think he was stalking me or anything, but he's just like, you look terrible. You know, like, you could see it on my face. I was not well. So I wasn't buying anything, but it was, like, I was using this as a tool to cope with something. And clearly that's how I got into the mess in the first place, right? So I was like, even though I wasn't spending the money and I was still budgeting, I was psychologically not well. So it's an indicator for me, like, when I do that, or I don't do it anymore, but back in the day, it was just like that blank face, and John just laughs at me every time. He's like, oh, remember that time I got you at Target, you know? So, I mean, think about that. There's, like, lasting psychological impact for some of these things. And so, like, there's a very intricate weaving of the two between finances and the extension of your psychology, because that's how the system is set up to be. Like, this is, like, done on purpose by the system we live in. So.
Oh, one other example. When a whole family is not very good with their finances and everybody's in debt, but the one member of the family gets out of debt, then it could evoke jealousy or this indignant kind of feeling, like, oh, you think you're better than us now? So sometimes there's social pressure not to do well financially so that you can kind of still belong with the family. This is a real thing.
For me, I really respect my father, especially he's very frugal about himself. Very less spend money, but he's very generous to other people. That is how I am. Good thing is, when I was in the college, at that time, I need to support myself. I was different city, but I need to support my living cost. So I did a part-time job. One thing I really think is I'm tied. Instead of tied to the church at the time, I tied, kind of set the fund, 10%. Even I not much money, I mean, when I was in the college, not much money I could get, but barely, like, support myself. But even with that much money, just 10% I set aside. And then I think this is money, so I need to help. I think it's God wants to see us how to spend money. And so it's this bond I need to use it. So it's how can I use it? So that is great for me, is I need to pay attention who needs money. This is not my money. This is just I'm just a delivery person. But I need to set the money, and whoever needs the money, I need to deliver. Yeah. That, even though it's not much, I mean, just how much money you can get. But it's very rich my life in some sense, even though it's, I mean, this is not touchable. I mean, anyway, you need to get the church, but set aside. But that is, mainly is to think about pay attention to that because of the fund. I need to use it. So it's I think that is a great lesson for me in the, during the college time, even though it's not that much money, but set aside and it wisely use this money to people who need it.
Wow. That's great practice. Wow. Well,
a couple things. I really appreciate this, by the way. And I'm just reflecting on everyone else's reflection. I was thinking about my own story, married story as well. And I think within my own cultural community and own family, there's so much shame around talking about finances because it's so much used against us that in my own I think my father, my grandmother, I still don't know if they're doing okay because they would never tell me. My dad was supposed to retire years ago. Like if he was, I mean, he doesn't tell me about his health either, but there's a lot of pride, which gets masked as resilience, which is not, it's just, you know, shame or whatever. So I think a lot about that. And for when you talked about what's keeping you back, what's holding you back, I think about just the shame. Even though we're doing okay, there's definitely areas where we could do better. And I think the shame of the confession and what that means, just culturally speaking, is a lot. I think the other piece, because I'm married to someone who is an immigrant, and I appreciate the examples that you gave, Pastor Jen, but I also realize that with some families, there's just such a financial need, whether they're immigrants or not, that the expectation of the people who are doing moderately well, not because they're trying to trick you, but because there's such a need that there's just no other reprieve.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's the other piece, too, with us, with our family, is that there is so much need all around us that we end up, whether we budget it or not, giving more than what we actually budgeted to do that.
And I think that's part of, like, I appreciate you sharing that. Because that's true, you know, like, especially when we come from family backgrounds that don't talk about that, like my family doesn't either, then you don't know if you should share either. You know, like, for a long time, I hid my stuff, my, like, the shame of being in so much revolving debt and having it be under control. Like, it took me a long time to go to Pastor Jen with it. And it took a long time for me to get out of debt because of it, too, because I kept on accruing for the time that I didn't share. And there's so much shame and pain and, like, yeah, it's really hard to come to terms with. I think one of the things that I shared last session was this is why it's so urgent for us to do this now as a social experiment in our church. Because, like, one of the questions that came up is, like, is someone asked if retirement or, like, 401k was evil. And I said, you know, in and of itself, the system that we live in does not support a retirement that is based on kinship or relationship or somebody taking care of you. Also, like, our lack of socialized medicine, lack of, you know, care for, like, the elderly and things like that is being, like, individualistic. Companies like making profit off of those things, like, it makes it impossible. So there's this, like, I just said, you know, we have to start now trying to do something different with our social, like, experiment here to experiment whether we can create a different kind of infrastructure. So when there is, like, a need like that, that's urgent, like, is there places where we can, like, help you to, like, get those funds together, you know, so that your family is not in need? Or, like, is there a way to provide care in a different way? You know, like, I think that's why it's so urgent to do it now, because our kids are affected by it. Like, our kids are affected by our psychology of debt, you know, and our kids are affected by our lack of knowledge and ignorance and then lack of discipline or whatever. But, like, and then they're really walking into a system that has no alternatives. And so, like, that's why it's so urgent for me to, like, talk about this and then share my experiences and share the way that, like, I mean, I was in $27,000 in credit card debt. It's a massive amount. That's like an annual salary for some people, you know? And it was on, like, revolving credit, like, APR, like, just, like, I don't know, $800 charged every month for interest only, you know? So, like... like, how do you get out of that? You can't. It's a pitfall. Like, there's like a quicksand, you know? So, like, I do think, I mean, those urgent crisis things needs to be addressed immediately. And we need to get those things taken care of. But, like, on the long term, we really want to set up a system where we can help each other out when things like that happen. Where you're not the isolated one family that has to deal with that. Like, but maybe there's several families that have those issues in, like, the larger, you know, family systems where, like, you're the only ones. So then, like, how do we as your family here, like, help you to manage that, you know, and to help you with those crises? Because it's not just, we care about you and your family, you know, and therefore by extension we care about your extended family. So that's really, like, my dream and my goal of, like, having a church that really can strive to do that, like, at least start to do that, even if it's not there yet, to have these conversations and have people on board so that, you know, it's not just like a few people being like, okay, let's try to do segmented ministry to improve the church, but, like, how do we have, like, an ethos that's like, okay, like, we are family, let's take care of each other. What does that look like? How do we do that? How do we improve our resources and, you know, care for each other so that we can do better with that, right? Because, like, the second session, like, the racialized history of the U.S., it's clear who benefits. It's clear who's not benefiting. And it's clear that there are, like, white male members and white female members that are going to do better than you and I, even if we start at the same time. Even if we're more educated, even if we're more aware, like, they're just going to progress faster, you know, just by their racial background. And, like, we have to be aware of those things, and those people need to, like, be invested in reallocating their privilege. And one of the things is, oh, I didn't even talk about this, but, you know, at the end of it all, like, if in this American context, if our end goal is not reparations, our gospel is not radical enough. Like, this financial responsibility stuff, it is rooted in radical activism because we're being anti-imperial. But if the end goal isn't reparations, really reparations, and we're not talking about that, then it's not radical enough to be the gospel. So, sorry I didn't include that. I don't know how I missed this one. Oh, because this was Daniel's slide. But I forgot that. It was here. But yes, like, that's the end goal of this. And this is the undergirding of the entire financial institute I did for, like, the last 4 weeks. This is where we need to land at the end of the day. We have to stop utilizing black bodies and, like, native land and immigrant labor in order to prop up white wealth. That's just not something that is supported by the gospel. It is not something that the churches can participate in and to encourage. And by doing nothing, we perpetuate it. So we have to do something different. Amen. I mean, for the sake of our kids, really. Amen. Our kids deserve better than this. So, anyways. That's my little preaching moment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. I just wanted to put this up. Thank you, Daniel.